Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Autism Mom Life Podcast. I am your host, Joni Tu. This podcast is a safe place where, just like the spectrum that autism is, we will cover a different number of topics. This is a village for people who need support and a place to educate those whose lives are impacted by autism. Let's share our stories, successes, and failures alike to help each other grow. This week, we are joined with by Mr. Bahij Kuzami. I'm going to give him a chance to introduce himself, and then we're going to jump right in.
Awesome.
Thank you for joining us, Bahij.
No problem. Thank you for the invite. I'm really honored and happy to be here.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I was about to introduce myself. It always gets weird for me when I introduce myself. It never gets familiar.
So
as you mentioned, my name is Bahij Kuzami. I am a board certified behavior analyst. I am an international behavior analyst. I am a member of the professional advisory board member for the IBAO, which is the International Behavior Analysis Organization. For UAE and Azerbaijan, and I'm also the founder of Autism Intervention Specialists in Dubai.
Well, thank you again. If you don't mind me asking, what made you pursue a career as an intervention specialist?
You know, this is going to sound like a cliche, but, you know, I, as most BCBAs, I hope so, that I have a passion for helping others. And you know, I like making difference in the people of in their lives. I like to make a difference. So throughout my journey, I've witnessed firsthand the profound impact that tailored, individualized, and compassionate support can have on people facing different challenges, and especially those with developmental delays or behavioral concerns. And to me, seeing a kid who never was able to brush his teeth or go out with his parents, that now he can, that's my reinforcement. This is my reward.
That sounds awesome. And I think you're right. I would hope that is the goal for all people, all professionals working in this field. So tell us about your educational background.
Sure. I have a master's degree in education / behavior analyst. That is what mentions on my degree. And I graduated from Cambridge College in Boston in Massachusetts with a focus on in autism specifically.
Okay. And do you think your education prepared you for your role?
My education gave me the bare minimum of this role. And if you are a BCBA, you will know that the ethical code says that passing your BCBA exam is the minimum requirement. And
right.
I believe that the hands-on experience and the trainings, the mentoring that you receive after your education is what will make you prepared for this role.
Awesome. And if you don't mind me asking, what made you want to specialize in autism?
Actually, I don't want to call it a family business, but it's kind of, because my oldest cousin is a BCBA since more than 20 years,
okay.
Since the board got their first certification. And then my brother is a BCBA, then I got to be a BCBA.
So. Oh, wow. So, yeah, it is a family business, it sounds like. So how long have you been working with children or individuals on the spectrum?
Almost 8 years now.
8 years. And what's the best experience that you've had as an intervention specialist?
Wow. It's going to be very difficult to narrow it down. I had a lot of good experiences, but I can tell you a recent one with a six-year-old that I have. He was non-vocal verbal, so no mode of communication at all, no sound, no speech, nothing. And by using PECS, which is the picture exchange communication system, we were able to encourage speech, produce a few words. Now he's talking in 4 or 5 words instead of communicating with problem behaviors. His problem behaviors really decreased, and his family are more relaxed now. He's more of a happy kid than he used to be. And I believe that's the success that we're looking for.
And, you know, I think a lot of times, excuse me, that people, even in the autism world, so to say, when you talk about the more profound individuals, the individuals with level 3 who don't have functional communication skills, when people think about what autism is, I think they think like Rain Man, and you know, you drop a box of matches and they can tell you exactly how many are on the floor.
Yeah.
I think that's a misconception in our society.
Yeah.
And also, my husband and I were just talking about this last night, that when you talk about services and interventions, most that are available, at least in our experience, I can't speak, you know, for everyone, but in our experience, what we have found that most are available cater to levels 1 and 2. Most interventionalists or RBTs, BCBAs, when you are faced with a level 3 child or a profoundly autistic child, especially once they get older, like my son is, you have problems trying to find consistent therapists because, one, you know, their size and puberty, and two, the behaviors that come with the lack of functional communication skills. So that's just our experience.
You're absolutely right. And I have a similar experience, because when I was in the States before I moved to Dubai now, most of the clients or the kids that I had were level 1, level 2, and not level 3. Mm-hmm. However, when I came to Dubai, the opposite happened.
Oh, wow.
The majority of my families now are on level 3, level 2 to level 3, and most of them on level 3. Because level 1 here are a little bit missed, and the parents don't want to either acknowledge or say that, you know, we do need support. Some of them they do, but very little. If the kid is on level 1 and he has full speech, they would say, well, he will grow out of it. The mentality is that he's fine. He's going to get better. It's nothing serious, you know, things like that. But level 2 and level 3 are the most dominant services in Dubai, from my experience.
Oh, if you don't mind me asking, what is the ratio of autistics and neurotypicals in Dubai or in the United Arab Emirates? Do you know what that number might be?
I don't believe they did that kind of study. I do know that in Saudi, in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, it's 1 for 100.
Oh wow! I think the latest number here, I'm going to look it up real quick. I don't want to misspeak. In the U.S.
is 1 to 36, I believe.
Yeah, I was thinking it moved, because when my son was diagnosed, it was 1 in every 44. And I was thinking it was 1 to 36 or 38.
In some states, it's 1 to 25. I think New Jersey, if I'm not mistaken, or New York, it's 1 in 25. But for the whole states, it's 1 in 36, I believe. Oh, that's what the CDC came out with recently. So what is the...
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, somewhere in the high 30s.
Yes.
So, as you know, I kind of blew up on TikTok by trying to share how to stay calm and manage challenging behaviors. Excuse me. And the reason I did that was, I remember years ago when our challenging behavior started, first thing I did was look on social media, because I can't be the only mom, you know, that child is faced with this. I couldn't be. And I remember this was probably in 2014. I got on YouTube and I only found one video, that showed behaviors of an older child that was, it reminded me of my son. And I was like, oh my gosh, because especially as a parent that has just received a diagnosis, you kind of want to look and see maybe what your future could be like. So you look for other people who are experiencing what you are. And that was the whole reason I posted what I did, was so that someone out there would not feel as alone as I had felt in the past, because I know that I'm not alone in this. And I know that we as a community can come together and support each other in this autism life, you know. So if you don't mind me asking, would you tell us about a time that you had a challenging interaction with a student and how you handled it?
Yes. So I would say every day is a challenge for us. Our job is to solve problems, but the most challenging experience, I would say, are when taking on new families and new cases, because we are not aware of the expectations of these families yet. Mm-hmm. And from a BCBA point of view, as a clinician, not the implementer or a behavior tech, my job is more difficult because I deal with parents. If I deal directly with the child, I don't have a problem. My problem is dealing with the family, is dealing with the parents, you know, the resistance that we get sometimes from the parents.
I imagine it can be challenging when you're like, okay, everything you thought you knew about raising a kid, you have to throw it out the window because it's completely different because of their wiring and the way they process information.
Yes, absolutely. And sometimes, you know, as clinicians, we have to have a lot of skills that they don't teach you in the school or in the university. Right. You know, you have to have some empathy, understanding, analytical skills, patience, flexibility, adaptability. Because if some family don't agree with you on something, you can't have a rock idea and say, no, this is what I say. You have to follow it. It will not work.
Right. So let's, if you don't mind, let's talk about what is early intervention and why is it so important?
Yes. So early intervention is to provide a systematic approach of giving services or interventions to children who may be at risk or have a developmental delays or disabilities. And the reason why it is called early is because it is delivered during a critical period of time, which is the early years of a child's development from birth until 3 years. And during that period, the brain is rapidly developing and learning, making it the optimal time to intervene and support positive developmental outcomes. Just like when you learn early years how to play piano, even if you stop 10 years, you don't play piano, you will still know how to play it.
Right.
Even with writing also. When you learn how to write, you can't unlearn how to write.
Right.
When you're a kid. When you learn a language when you're a kid, you will not forget that language later on. Same things for everything you learn at early age. It will stick with you. It will stay with you because of that period of time and what you put in at early ages.
So what should a parent or caregiver be looking for when they are researching early interventions?
You know, now social media is all over and it's big, mm-hmm. and a lot of commercials, a lot of businesses, you know, trying to make money out of it. A lot of attractive packages for sure. But I would say, look for an honest, ethical, and flexible BCBA to work with you, or an early intervention program. The program can be, the thing with that is, if the supervisor is not what I just described, mm-hmm. no program will work. Even if you have the best written program in the whole world, if you don't have a supervisor supervising that program, it's not going to work. Because not all of them are like that. Some they only follow the textbook. Some are not ethical in their approach. They would rather disregard the ethical guidelines to get faster results. So they would rather use punishment to let's say, show the family that progress is there quickly. Because our guidelines say, or ethical guidelines say, you use positive reinforcement first before you go and look for punishment procedures. So some are not willing to learn also new things and to keep up with the progress of this field and many, many things as well. But what they should look for, what I would say is an honest and ethical person who works with a clear conscience.
So, and I experienced this myself, talking about what the difference is between an evaluation and an assessment. Because before I got into, you know, trying to get ABA, I always thought those were the same thing. Because if you evaluate something, you assess it, I thought. So from a BCBA's point of view, can you explain what the difference is between an evaluation and an assessment? Absolutely. And what can parents do to prepare for an assessment?
Great. I love that question. Because as you mentioned, people think it is the same. It's not the same. So the purpose of an assessment is to gather information as much as we can to gather information, data. We do observations. We want to understand a specific situation, a specific condition, or individual need, what that person needs are. So gathering that information in order to make informed decisions or recommendations is the main purpose of an assessment. So when we make an assessment, we're gathering information about, some they call it client, some they call it patient, so some they call it student, so that we can make the best judgment possible for a plan. With evaluation is to make judgments or determine if the plan is effective or not, or if the plan has been achieved. So how would I know that a plan or an intervention or something that we gave is effective, it has quality, whatever it is that it's working, by doing what? So it also provides feedback, evaluation, and it also provides feedback for improvement. Because if we see that there is no improvement, then we're going to have to give feedback to get to the improvement. That's what evaluation is.
That makes so much sense. I could never separate it in my mind. So how can we as parents prepare for an assessment?
Yeah. So the first thing is be as honest as possible. A lot of parents, they do want to hide some facts. Maybe they feel shame. Maybe they feel guilt for whatever other reasons. Gather information as much as you can from different sources that you might have. Be open. Write down your concerns, take notes, ask questions. All these things can help us during the assessment.
Do you find that especially parents with more profound children, level 3 children, do you find that they tend to hide maladaptive behaviors more so than your lower level of need families?
Yes, to a certain extent. And that would be also depending on some cultures, because I've been in the States and now I'm in the Middle East. So I can a little bit anecdotally, I don't have data, but anecdotally, I can say that some nationalities or some cultures, they have more that than others. But it all depends on the person as well. So I've had same nationalities or cultures, but they were amazing. Like, they were great. So
I experienced that just in like support groups and such. You find that some parents carry a lot of shame behind their child's behaviors. And I've been guilty of that myself. You know, we've been in certain public places to where the behaviors that Cash had, my son, were not received very well. And my automatic response is, oh, I'm sorry, you know, and get out of here, you know. Whereas now I find I try to use those moments as teachable moments, and say, you know, this, he has autism and he is really overwhelmed. So we're just going to need a minute and need some space.
Yes.
And actually, I posted a video a few weeks ago, and I am convinced that the people at Walmart that we went to had seen it, because that was the first time I posted a video. And I said, you know, if you see a mom or a parent or a caretaker or whoever in a store, and you have a child who is obviously melting down, don't judge. Just ask if you can help them in any way. Most of the time we're going to say no, because we've got this. This is just, you are seeing it for the first time, and it may not even be as bad for us as you think it is.
Yes.
But just be kind and say, hey, is there anything I can do to help? And we had a little meltdown in Walmart. Cash was over it. We'd been in there too long. And on top of that, they completely rearranged our Walmart. And Yes, the first time we went in there, we walked in like 20 feet. He says, get me out of here. And like, he did not. We don't do change well. I don't really do change well myself.
Yeah.
But anyway, we had made it. He had made it. He did so well. And then at the checkout, total dysregulation, lost it.
Wow.
And that was the first time, though, I experienced two or three people coming and saying, hey, how can we help you? And I was like, I think you saw my TikTok. I didn't say that, obviously, but I was like, I think you saw my TikTok.
Nice.
So I was like, that's it. Because we, you know, we live in a society where, you know, we are in the most tolerant society that the world has ever been in. To accept each other the way that we are and own and be proud of who we are, no matter our differences. And so that was really rewarding for me to see that, yes, okay, some people, somebody out there is getting it, that instead of being judgmental, just give us some space and ask us if we can help. Because, you know, my help might be, hey, can you call my mama? Or can you call my husband?
Yeah.
Sorry, I got off on a little bit of a tangent
No problem. This is the month of Autism Awareness Month, but I think you hit the nail there, where this is acceptance. And that's what we also need to be promoting, more than just awareness. It's acceptance as well. And that right there, those three people who told you that, they have showed acceptance.
Yes. And that's something, I actually had a conversation with a young lady last week. She's like, no, like just completely X mark on the awareness. And I said, you know, I can respect that to a point, that that's your opinion, but that's as far as I can respect it, because how do you accept something that you are not aware of?
Yeah.
You have to be aware in order to accept, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But that's just me. So you said you're a BCBA. I have found that a lot of people do not know what ABA is. Could you tell us what does ABA stand for? And just about that therapy as a whole.
Sure. So ABA stands for Applied Behavior Analysis, which is, it is the science of human behavior. This is in simple terms, as simple as an explanation that it is, as it can be. It's the science of human behavior. It's not the science of autism,
right?
And it's not the only approach for autism. It is the science of a human behavior. It's just happened that it has a very solid scientific evidence behind it, that it works most with children with autism or with individuals with autism. That's why it was adopted or known for ABA means autism, or autism means, you know, these kind of things.
I had spoken to Cassia's first BCBA, and when she described it to me, I was like, oh, so you're like a profiler. Essentially, Because if you think about, I love the show Criminal Minds and Hotch and his team, the BAU man, that's what they do. They analyze human behavior. And I was like, so you could be like, you're like Hotch of autism. Not really, but I just thought it was very cool that yes, it's really narrowly thought of. I think that when people associate ABA with autism and it ends there, when in fact, that's not the case at all. There's many fields that you can go into with your expertise and your knowledge.
Absolutely. And if anybody wants to know more about what are the subcategories that a BCBA can do, they can go check out the website from the BACB, and they can see that there's a whole bunch of specialties. But the thing is that autism is the major one. So you will see most of the BCBAs, especially in the United States, they do work with children with autism or with disabilities, but it also there are few that they are doing organizational behavior management, pediatric behavior analyst. Would they work with dementia? They work with patients with substance abuse. A lot of stuff, health and fitness, a lot of things. I do have a responsibility to a little bit answer to what you said about the profilers, because there's a book that we read the first semester in our master's degree in ABA. And it was called 25 Essential Skills for a Behavior Analyst. And one of the chapters was, I hope I'm not saying the wrong book, but I can correct that and then send it to you. It says that people think that BCBA or a behavior analyst is the same as a profiler, which in fact it's not.
Oh, I'm
So,
sorry.
yeah.
See, I'm learning something myself.
Yeah. There's a whole chapter on that, and it's not because what we do is we rely on data, and based on data we analyze the behavior, whether compared to a behavior profiler, they look at the person and they assume that this is why they're doing something.
Oh,
So,
okay.
yeah.
Yep, that makes sense because they're not actually looking at whoever they're just taking what little bit they know and
They don't
assuming,
have
making
data.
assumptions.
They don't have data. Like they're not
No.
collecting data. They don't see the person for several sessions, and there's no graphs that they're looking for. They're not
Gotcha.
providing reinforcement. They're not controlling the environment. They're not manipulating the environment. So it's kind of a little bit different.
Well, see, folks, now we've all learned something new, okay? I was under a misconception myself. So, okay, let me go ahead and is there any cost associated with early intervention?
Yes. So early intervention in the States might be covered by insurance or funded by the state, or maybe by like Medicaid or MassHealth. I know MassHealth in Massachusetts, but in other countries it is privately paid. So let's say in UAE, in United Arab Emirates, it's all privately paid. You will have very little government authority or a private insurance that they do pay for any kind of service, not just early intervention. Even ABA is not covered. And if they cover it, they cover a very small cap per year, and it's very expensive. So it is all privately paid.
We dealt with that early on, with my son when he was a toddler. Our state had not recognized the benefit of ABA yet. And so in order to get ABA for him, it was like, I don't know, this was back in 2013 or 14. I want to say it was $60,000 to $80,000 a year that we
Wow.
would have had to pay out of pocket. And we were working middle class people with a mortgage and bills, and that was not doable for us. And it wasn't until our state, our one of our governors, I can't remember who, I think it was Pat McCrory. I'm wrong. I'm sorry if I'm wrong. I believe it was him who signed it into law that now insurance companies cover ABA therapies. But then there were such wait lists too. That's something I don't know if y'all deal with that, but and some of my followers think that I am telling a story or fibbing or whatever you want to call it. But I have been on two or three wait lists, I know, since 2018, maybe four. And I check back every 6 months or a year, and it's still, and they tell me the same thing, check back in 6 months.
Wow.
It's not as easy to receive services as I think people think it is, especially people not in our this autism life that we're living. It's not that easy. Sorry, my iPad turned off.
I absolutely agree with you. This life is not for everyone, and not everybody understand it. So I would say if the parents are in that group, they are in a really special group that they understand each other without even talking.
Yes. So, what does ABA therapy look like?
A lot of misconceptions still out there from autistic adults that they are anti or anti, whatever you want to call it, anti-ABA. I think we should move past that. Like, we're not the only field or the only science that did wrong. Nobody is saying that we started good. Every field started with its own mistakes, but now it's not this. It's not like this anymore. So under the hands of a skilled and ethical BCBA, it looks a life-changing therapy for both the child and the parents. This is what I will say, because there's nothing better than ABA, not just for the child, even for yourself. You can change your own behavior using ABA techniques. You can change your spouse's behavior. Like, I'll give you a personal example. Let's say my wife doesn't like to wash dishes, for example, right? As a BCBA, she's living with a BCBA, so I have to change that behavior. If I want to change that behavior, I know that by talking that the behavior is not going to change. So I'm not going to tell her, "Hey, listen, can you please wash the dishes?" And then I start argue. She starts arguing. It ends up with a fight. As soon as, first of all, I'll take a baseline. This is the proper ABA method. I'll take a baseline. How many dishes or how many cups does she wash herself? And I take it down on a piece of paper. And then as soon as I start my intervention could be for every cup or every dish that she washes, I give her, let's say, some allowance or some money, whatever, So, or a social praise, or paired with a social praise. So I give her a social praise, and then I give her a little bit of money, and then I start increasing the time or the amount of the dishes and the cups and the stuff that she wants, that I want her to do more before she can get the money, for example. After a few weeks or whatever, she's happy, I'm happy, no argument. She's making extra money. I changed her behavior. Nobody knows what happening. Nobody was planning to do anything. I didn't tell her, "Hey, listen, if you don't do the dishes, I'm gonna do ABA on you." We don't say that.
I'm gonna give this advice to my husband. Like, yes, can you give me a few dollars and a good job so I can
And
wash
for
more dishes?
yeah, I mean, yeah, like for a parent, what
Oh
do the
yeah.
kids? What do they want? They want the parents' affection, attention.
Yes.
So that is your strongest reinforcer. If you know how to, how when to deliver it, when not to deliver it, when to withhold it, these kind of things, it's very powerful. It's very powerful in changing kids' behavior.
Thank you for saying that, because I've never thought about that. Like, what is the driving force behind motivation in children? But that is exactly right. They want you to stop what you're doing and play with them, or stop what you're doing and watch a movie with them, or scratch their back, or put their shoes on, even though they're capable of it themselves. It's you that they're wanting. So thank you for that. That was a little life lesson right there. So does ABA help with behaviors that are harmful or destructive?
Yes, absolutely. So ABA can be highly effective in addressing behaviors that are harmful or destructive. There's a whole body of literature, more than 50, 60 years of research showing that it does work and it is effective because it focuses on understanding the function of the behavior. And also it teaches alternative skills and implementing evidence-based strategies to promote positive behavior change and to improve quality of life. We don't make assumptions. We don't say, okay, well, when he hurt himself, give him a fidget, or when he hurt himself, take a fidget from him, or don't give him what, based on what these interventions are being given. So we don't make assumptions. That's why there are a functional behavior assessment. There's teaching replacement skills. Every behavior has a function. There is no behaviors that they come out of nowhere or out of the blue. Every single human behavior has four functions. I know we don't have time, so I won't go into that now, but every behavior has four functions. Our job as BCBA is to find out what are those functions and to teach the person an alternative replacement behavior that serves the same function.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, maybe we can do another episode and talk about the functions of behavior. That would be awesome. I have just a few more questions for you before we hop off right here.
Yeah.
So what ages can benefit from ABA?
All ages. Anyone
anyone
can apply the principles of ABA or the principles of behavior to change their own behavior or the behavior of others.
And so I guess this, you answered that in this, is I know like the goal mark age of getting intervention with ABA, I think is like between 2 and 6 or something, right? Yes. Really early on in development. Is it too late to get a consistent, appropriate, ethical ABA therapy in place when they're 12 or 13? Is it too late for it to be functional or purposeful then?
I will give you this analogy. Maybe it will make it clear for the listeners. Imagine you planted a seed and it grew a little bit from the ground. And you planted another seed that you have been watering for 12 years, and now it became a strong tree. Which one is easier to take out from the ground?
Oh, the little seed.
Exactly. Same thing with what you just said. When we intervene at early age, we are trying to remove that small seed that it's only a couple of years or months or whatever. So those behaviors, those severe problem behaviors, whatever problem is there that we're trying to address by using ABA, it's easier to change it at that age, especially that 2 to 6, rather than if the person is 12, 16, 20, 25, and the older, the longer, the harder, the more resistant the person will be in changing that behavior.
That is a great analogy.
Thank you.
Wow. Yeah, that is I've never thought of it that way. Like Oprah calls them aha moments. That was one. I've had a lot of aha moments in this conversation. So what are the outcomes of ABA?
Well, there's a lot of outcomes. I'll just mention a few. First of all, improved communication skills, social skills development, behavior reduction, increase in functional behaviors, academic improvement. The biggest one that everybody talks about is independence. We all want them to become independent. Mostly the parents. The biggest question I get: what do I do? What are they going to become, or what's going to happen to them when we die, or when the parents they die? So independence. It also self-regulation, enhanced focus and attention. Generalization of skills. I would say this is a very important skill to learn, because most of the other therapies, they do the therapy in one place, but those skills are not generalized outside that setting, which ABA they do as much as possible. But we have a target of generalization of those skills. And the last one I would say is improved quality of life in general.
Yeah, I have. I found that that's something that we struggle with is generalization. We have a different set of behaviors in each location that we're at, depending on past experiences in those locations. and expectations. Now, I have two sons with autism, Cash and Colt. I primarily talk about Cash because he is more profound. Although Colt is level two, he does require moderate support. And I am just learning, really, that a lot of his behaviors where he doesn't look as high of a support is because he's masking. And I have some guilt in that of not recognizing, that he's just masking and he's covering his behaviors. And I didn't recognize that until he mentioned, I asked him why he did or did not do something at school. And he said, because they'll see or they'll know. And I was like, okay, so you're very keenly aware. And you're like, yeah. So he keeps his stimming. He stims so much after he gets home from school. During the summer, he stims some, but not to the, I mean, it's almost hard to watch, because he stims so much after he gets home from school. And I'm like, have you just been holding all this in all day? Because his friends don't walk around doing this or flapping or any of the self-stimulatory behavior that he requires. And he actually asked to be homeschooled. He's like, can I be homeschooled next year? And I'm like, is it just that stressful maintaining that mask of a day? So I don't know, maybe do you think that could be a possibility that it's a lot of anxiety caused by him having to mask his behaviors
Yes,
so that he's not picked on?
there's a lot of pressure and a lot of social pressure in schools and in educational settings, where if the person has the ability to mask those traits, they will explode when they go back home. And I have had a lot of students who have the similar profile in the nursery or in the school. They hold off until they get home, and then they explode. A lot of energy, a lot of stimming. They take longer to de-escalate from the day. Sometimes it takes days before they become regulated themselves. So it depends on each person.
Yeah, Colt, he I just had a thought in my mind. Do you ever have that happen? You think of something and it just flies
Yeah,
away.
absolutely. A lot of thoughts.
I just had a
You
thought right
have
here,
a lot going
and
on.
it'll come back to me because before we
Sure.
get off, we've only got a couple minutes left, but I do want to talk about, I just watched one of your videos last night about pathological demand avoidance. This is something that is really not talked about at very much. In fact, your video was like the first time I've heard something that I could put a name to it. Because both of my boys, Cash, I get so many comments about, well, he's always right here over your shoulder. Cash is always within arm's reach of me. Colt, Colt's 8, and I'm trying to teach him about privacy, but he struggles if I go to the restroom or if I go to the restroom, take a shower or change clothes. It gives him anxiety to not be with me. And I didn't know if you could speak and let that be our final question is, can you speak about pathological demand avoidance? And my husband said that he said that sounds like you. I think that's probably just stubbornness. So for those out there who are listening and think that maybe this just sounds like stubbornness, is it stubbornness or is it actually something with a name?
Okay. Since we have a couple of minutes, I won't also comment on the term stubbornness, but stubbornness is the term that most people use to describe some behavior. But anyways, that's for another day. So pathological demand avoidance, it showed up, I believe, at in the 1980s by a psychologist. But until now, it's not a formal diagnosis because it doesn't have a lot of history and proof. Like, to be evidence or to be in the DSM-5 or in the DSM manual, which is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Health Disorders, it has to have at least some 17 or 20 years, something like that. A lot of research to be done. Many people, they have replicated and done it before they considered as a formal diagnosis. The point of PDA is that the person will become avoidant for anything that comes from another person, even if it's very simple as drink your water or eat your food or put your jacket, we're going to go. Just because somebody else said it, they will stop doing it. They will say, I'm not doing it. Or they will just not respond just because you said that to them. So that avoidance happens because they have anxiety over not being able to control their environment. So because they have a very strong sense of controlling, they want to control everything.
Right.
So they start avoiding these kind of things. So,
and is PDA only seen in individuals with autism, or is it seen in individuals that do not have autism?
It is being acknowledged and discussed more within the field of autism, and like particularly in the UK, it's being talked about more often there. But it is part of the autism, especially with, I would say, level one. I used to work with a girl, 6-year-old girl. She was on the level one autism spectrum. And she would sit blank for 3 hours if you tell her to do anything. Nothing. For 6 months, the school couldn't do anything with her regarding academics or homework or to participate. As soon as the teacher says, everybody, pick up your pencils, and then she doesn't, or something happens, she didn't hear, and then she says, your name, pick up your pen, that's it.
Yeah.
That's it.
We did a lot of that with Cash. Yeah. They could not get him to do work. Yeah. And even up till this year with Colt, and I think Colt is just progressed developmentally and he's learned more masking skills. Had the same problem last year. They're like, we cannot get him to do anything.
Wow.
But then at home, I could get him to do it with no problem.
Yeah.
Or with little resistance. But both of my boys, I did some research last night and just reading, and I was like, oh my gosh, this sounds like them. And my husband's like, yeah, that sounds like you. So I was like, maybe not. But I want to say thank you again, Bahij, for joining us and sharing your expertise with us. It has been a pleasure to have you on the show. And yeah, we will definitely have to do this again. I've learned so much, and I appreciate you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Me as well.
All right, guys. So that concludes today's episode. Thank you all again for listening. I want to give a special shout out to my financial supporters. I don't expect any financial support, but it is appreciated. And as always, #BeLikeThumper. See you next episode.